Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller with the club's Business and Leadership Forum, and your host for today's program, which is entitled Bank Lending on the Hot Seat, What Lies Ahead. I also want to make note that this program is being presented in association with the Graduate Business Alumni Chapter of the St. Mary's College. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet often at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. We have a wonderful panel this evening of three speakers. And be moderated by a gentleman that I'm going to introduce now, and then he will in turn introduce each of our panelists. So the moderator for tonight's program is Mr. Tom Cleveland, the Transamerica Professor of Finance at St. Mary's College. Tom's distinguished career includes 17 years as partner and CPA at Deloitte & Touche, with the last 6 years in the position of National and International Director of Banking. He has served as CEO, CFO, and Chief Lending Officer at two different banks. He has also served as the mayor of the city of Lafayette. Tom is a graduate of the University of Michigan, Stanford, and UC Davis with his PhD. Please join me in welcoming Tom Cleveland.
Thank you, Tom. I'm delighted to be here. This is not part of what I expected to say, but before the speakers arrived, I had some idea what they might be talking to us about. And all three that I've gotten to know tell me they're going to surprise me tonight. So the hot seat for me was sitting there wondering what they're going to say. Since November, I've been collecting various articles that pertain to bank lending. And I now have the articles and magazines and actually a book are about a foot high right now. And there's a couple I looked at today that I thought streamlined why this is an important panel. One of them said that bank lending to small business is down 37% from last year. The other is President Obama gave a speech from the White House in a meeting with many bankers, in which he said we just have to get at this lending, and one of the reasons we need more lending is we need more jobs. We have here today what I consider, if they're not the top three, they're certainly the top five, bankers and bank lending by experience. What I have in mind for them, and I'm not going to change my mind, I've asked each one of them to address one of the flyer statements was there concerning banking. So they're going to pick one of those questions, and I'll tell you for each one what it is. And then they're going to talk about their bank and any other ideas that they wish to discuss. Our first speaker is Perry Pelles. He's a executive vice president of Wells Fargo Bank, and has recently been appointed head of commercial banking for Wells Fargo. So he has great vision and great experience. He joined Wells Fargo in 1987 and is a graduate of Northwestern University with a BA and an MBA. He's going to speak on a specific question: what is the future of credit and bank lending for businesses as well as individuals? That'll be his topic. He will then talk about Wells Fargo and bank lending. Please welcome Perry Pelles.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here, and thank you to St. Mary's and the Commonwealth Club for inviting me. As I mentioned to Tom, he probably couldn't get who he really wanted, so he settled on me. So, again, thank you for having me here. I am going to talk for just a couple of minutes about some of the things that I think are important relative to the future of lending, and then I look forward to answering your questions and hearing your thoughts and ideas when I'm finished. Any conversation about bank lending in the future, which is what we're here to speak to tonight, has to start with a conversation about what happened in the past, and perhaps we can learn some lessons from that. And so some of the members of the audience appear to be under the age of 35, so I'll take you back to a galaxy far, far away a long time ago. It was called the 70s or the early 80s. And believe it or not, when you have to, when you wanted to buy a car back then, you'd have to give them money. It was called a down payment. I know it seems kind of strange. You don't have to do that anymore. But you used to actually have to write a check and give them money before they would give you a car. Imagine that. And so, you know, somewhere along the line, people thought, you know, this down payment thing is a little too tough. I want to be able to sell more cars. Somebody, you know, people want to buy more cars. And so what happened was they kind of got rid of the down payment, right? And so they just said, you know, finance the whole amount of the car. And again, I don't know who did it, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. And so it just kind of happened, right? And we did the three-year loan. And then the three-year loan, the payments were a little too high, so we did the four-year loan, right? Because the payments are lower. You stretch it out over a longer period of time. And then we did the five-year loan. And then when that kind of ran out, we did the leasing product, right? And so the leasing product was really great because your payments were lower. Of course, you didn't own anything, but, you know, that's a story for another day. So that's kind of what happened. And so people that have bought cars of a certain age in the past 10 years probably don't understand that this is kind of an unusual period of time. If you look back over from a historical standpoint, most of the time that isn't how you did it, right? You actually had to own the car and fix it and do other stuff to it. And then we took that same strategy, we being the collective we, and we did it with housing, right? You used to have to put a down payment to buy a house. I remember when I bought my first house, I borrowed the money from my, worse than borrowing it from my parents, I borrowed it from my in-laws, right? All right, so talk about pressure, right? It was, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, okay, boy, I got to really, you know, buckle down here and pay this back. Well, then we got to the point where you didn't have to do that anymore, right? And you didn't need the in-laws anymore. Right, there was this blissful period of time where that occurred. And again, if we look back on this period of time, I think we will look at it as an aberration as opposed to something that is normal. Right, and we got used to something that was an aberration, and so now when we go back to something that is normal, it's going to seem kind of strange to us at first because we're used to something different. For one of the first jobs I ever had, I was a bank teller. And I remember, these were the days where people would come in with their savings passbook, and I would have to type it into the passbook. Days before computers, you know, they'd give you their money, I'd type it in the passbook. And they also had something called a Christmas Club account, right? And it, this was, people used to, I kid you not, it was a separate account, and people would put like $5 or $10 a week into this account. And it would, they'd save money so that when the holidays came, they'd have money to buy gifts, right? And that was the deal. And it was a savings account. You could get 2 or 3% in that. But that was before people used credit cards, really, to buy their gifts, right? It was in those days that you kind of did it that way. So imagine that. We used to save money to pay for Christmas presents. Who does that anymore? I mean, but think about it. You know, maybe that was better. Maybe that was better because then you didn't have the January hangover where you got your credit card bill and you go, she's my cousin. It's not worth $55. What did I do that for, right? But if you had it in the Christmas Club, at least, you know, you didn't owe the money at that point. So I think a lot of the things that we sort of did 20 years ago, 25 years ago, are going to become a little bit more of what we're going to see in the future. Probably not all of them, but my perspective is some of that stuff is going to come back because it needs to. and some of the foundations of our economy need to be rebuilt. And this is going to take some time, it's going to take effort and energy, and it's going to take people working together and coming up with ideas and trying to help one another as opposed to trying to point fingers and, you know, accuse people of bad things. The search for the villain continues with people in my industry playing the part very well. There were abuses. People acted badly. People did things that they shouldn't have done, and those people should be found out, and those people should be brought to whatever justice needs to be brought to them, because there were abuses in the system. There were abuses in the mortgage system. There were abuses in the investment banking world. There were abuses in the banking world, and those things need to be addressed. And so personally, and from the standpoint of my company, we feel that the regulatory environment needs to be such and the legal environment needs to be such that if somebody's doing something wrong, it gets addressed, because it makes us look bad as an industry, and we don't want to have ourselves look bad by having some bad actors in there doing things that don't necessarily make sense for people. So we are very supportive of some of the changes that have been proposed, but I think some of the changes that have been proposed need to be discussed so people can understand them, because there are unintended consequences to some of the changes, and we'll talk more about that later in the Q&A period. Sometimes we want simple answers, and an economy as large and complex as ours doesn't really lend itself to simple answers, and only with the passage of time can you really understand that some of the things that we thought were true might not necessarily have been the case. And so I think it behooves all of us to be a little bit careful in terms of some of the remedies that we're proposing. Good policy isn't often made in a week. Good policy is made over a period of time. And so I think, again, some reflection, some understanding, looking at exactly why we got to where we got and trying to understand some of the implications of the remedies is a good thing. And so I would encourage all of you, as you think about that in your personal life and your business life, and you think about some of the changes that are proposed, that we think about that. The future, I think, is very bright for this country. And I think there's going to be a manufacturing renaissance in this country, the likes of which we haven't seen in a while. I think the people who are counting our democratic society out are going to be disappointed. It's going to be a future that doesn't involve manufacturing being big steel in Detroit, but it's going to be a manufacturing sector of microchips, biotechnology, bioengineering, solar, all the technologies of the future. And we have a great opportunity to build that future in this country, particularly in California. I think California is uniquely positioned with this great educational network that we have, with our dedication to people improving their status in life and their ability to learn new skills. I think we are uniquely positioned to have that. From my perspective, the banks, and ours in particular, are the facilitators of that. The entrepreneurs take the risks. The entrepreneurs come up with the ideas, and our only role is to facilitate their success. If they're successful, we're successful. If they're not, we're not. From a personal standpoint, I'm looking forward to the future as well. The past 18 months have been probably some of the most challenging from a personal standpoint that I've had in my career. I get accused of a lot of things that I haven't done, and that's okay, because of the job I have, I'm expected to take that. But the thing that really is difficult to take is I've got 1,200 team members on my team that haven't done anything wrong, and yet they're accused of doing a lot of bad things. And I don't think that's necessarily a good thing for this country, to have 1,200 bankers who can help us succeed feel bad about what they're doing. And I think we need to be, again, very careful about what we're accusing people of and who we're accusing it, that what we're accusing them of doing. We bank thousands of companies in my group. They employ millions of people. And it's very important for us to understand that our success is tied to theirs. I have no people on my group that sit behind computer screens and try to guess about directions of markets to get rich. All of my people are decked against customers. They worry about what their customers' needs are. They try to meet those needs. Sometimes they make mistakes. When they make mistakes, we try to fix them. But they are all decked against the needs of our customers. So we're looking forward to helping our customers grow and succeed so they can go out and hire people and they can build more plant and equipment and that we can get this economy going. So again, thank you for inviting me this evening. I look forward to your questions and ideas coming up.
Very thoughtful, Perry. Let's give him a nice round. Steve Buster, I've known for a period of time. He's president and CEO of Mechanics Bank of Richmond, California, since July 2004. Before coming to Mechanics, he was a managing director for U.S. Trust Company. His 35 years in banking include 5 years in London. He travels well, obviously. He was with First Interstate Bank and 5 years in Singapore with Standard Chartered Bank, managing their Asia-Pacific region. He's a graduate of the University of Southern California with a BA and MBA. This wasn't quite the year for Southern California, but it's been quite a year for Mechanics Bank. He's going to speak on the specific question, what can we expect by way of new products, regulations, restrictions, opportunities, and risks? Then he'll talk about Mechanics Bank and particular things that you might be thinking about there. Let's welcome Steve Buster.
First of all, I'm just blown away that you skipped the State of the Union to watch us three bozos talk about banking. But we're honored that you're here. And I can tell you, for all three of us, we are sitting in a hot seat right now. I've never seen a hot seat like this for our industry as it is today. But really, do we look like demons to you? I don't think so. We're not. We're not. And I thought I'd just start out my talk totally off pace from what Tom wanted me to do by asking you all a question, and that is, do you think, the first question is, do you think that the country, Treasury, should have supported and bailed out the banking industry the way they did? Now, if you think they should have, I'd like you to raise your hand right now. Okay, I'd now like to take a poll. Do you think they should not have? Raise your hand. Okay, very interesting. It's a divided house. A divided house. So I wanted to start my talk to try and persuade you why it should have been. And frankly, as a community bank, Mechanics Bank happens to be one of the strongest capitalized banks in the state of California. Liquid, we've made solid profits through all this. You would have thought it's in my interest to say, let them fail, more for me. But I don't feel that way. And I don't feel that way because of the background. I have an eclectic background, and I want to explain this to you of how I've come to this important conclusion. I worked in international and capital markets for over 20 years, First Interstate Bank and Standard Chartered. Standard Chartered used to own Union Bank here in the old days. They're about 150 years old. They're all over Asia Pacific in every country except North Korea, very big. And my bank, First Interstate, sold me like a baseball player to them, my international group. And so I wound up going to Singapore. My job was all of the wholesale banking activities in Asia Pacific. And Standard Chartered grew up there as a central bank for a lot of these countries. And if you go to Hong Kong today, you'll see Standard Chartered Bank prints about 25% of the money. It has their name on it. That's legal tender. And that's their long-term role. And so as I went there, I would often visit with the Minister of Finance or the central banker, and I'd talk about their country and what was going on. And I learned an awful lot from the inside perspective of these countries. I used to see capital run out of these countries massively when there was big trouble. And they'd come to where I was based, Singapore. They'd park their money until there was a devaluation, and then they'd take it back and buy up the world. And so we had a lot of inside information from that. We had Standard Chartered, had an office, many offices. We probably had 60 offices in the Hong Kong area. But we had many offices, and one of them had a bus break down in front of it. And the bus unloaded, and then a tow truck came, took the bus away. And so all the people in the building saw this line of people in front of our office, and they thought it was a bank run. They came out of those buildings and lined up, I'm telling you, down the whole block, around the other side, and back up the other side of the block. Pay me, pay me, pay me. We called the central bank. Send a truckload of money. Two trucks came. We loaded the office with money behind there, and we paid, and we paid. And everybody was panicked. Give me my money. Until 2 o'clock, they were all paid. And they looked out there and said, shucks, I guess they have the money. I don't want to sleep on it tonight. And they put it back. And it came back in the office, and we piled it behind, called the trucks, they came up and picked it up. That's a true story. Why were they so panicked? They were panicked because there was no FDIC insurance or anything like that. They were panicked because it was their money. They saw a run, and they were terrorized. Everything I have, I got to go get it. What I'm trying to convey is that the banking system is fundamental to the foundation and health of any economy. You cannot build an economy without confidence in the banking system. If that fails, it's all gone. You can't build anything. And the price we pay for being in the industry to be that foundation is that we have to be heavily regulated because we have to have the public's trust. And so when I think of those Treasury guys at midnight trying to figure out what in the world we do, what do we do now? Do we bail this out and put our billions in there, or do we let this go? And at risk was the foundation and confidence of our economy and the world economy. And I respect them for what they did. It was bold, it was tough, and we made it. And now we're coming out. So that's the first story I wanted to tell you to try and get you to understand that I think this was the right thing to do. I don't like a lot of what happened, and I'm going to talk maybe later if the question is asked about TARP and how it was used, and we'll get into that. But there's another thing going on in our industry right now. We know housing's been the lead negative indicator and a problematic segment of our entire economy, of people's welfares. It's awful. I mean, this is a terrible thing. And so the reaction is to put in safeguards to prevent lenders from acting on their collateral, to taking it over, to selling it. And it sounds like the right thing to do, doesn't it? Well, how long should we give? Should it be a year? Should it be 2 years? How long do we give? And so a lot of local legislators are trying to make decisions and put things in for their communities, cities, nationally. I don't know about you. I love Mexico. I go down there all the time. Have you seen how long it takes to build a house in Mexico? The average time to build a house is 12 years. Do you know why? Mexico had worries and wanted to protect their consumers, and they block foreclosure, and a person can stay in his or her house almost forever. And so they can't realize on their collateral. And so the only way you can build a house is brick by brick from your own cash flow, and it takes a family about 12 years to build the house, and just when the kids are grown up to leave, you own it. You got a roof. And that's because Mexico did what they did. Nobody lends in mortgages in Mexico. Nobody does construction lending. Do we want that? I can tell you capital's smart, and it knows not to go into things that are going to fail or be unprofitable or be limited as to protecting your shareholders or your depositors. So those are the two little stories. Now, I'm going to get into the really interesting part that Tom asked me to cover, and I'll just spend a few minutes on it. And that is, we talk about new products, regulations. We're going to get into regulations. I'm not going to cover much on that. Restrictions, opportunities, and risks. I've never seen a time like this. It's a very interesting thing. Products. My kids walk down the street and pay their bills through their pant legs with little iPhones, and they're pressing their I don't know how they do this. Who would have thought people would get married on the internet? They never met. They fall in love. I really know this person. And they meet and get married. Who would have thought? This is a different world. We have to somehow adjust and deliver our services over the same sort of technologies that are being embraced. So whether you want to Twitter or whether you want to go to Facebook or, you know, all the social media, our banks need to address that and be a part of it. And we need to figure out how to do this. Because when you come to my bank, and I know it's the same for my friends here, you come to our banks, we want the safest house of security and confidence that things are going to work and your money is safe and no one's going to steal from your account. And that's why we have passwords and complications and extra systems to check it is the same cell phone or it is your same computer. And the cyber thieves are out there big time. This is incredible. Do you know they put software from the internet into your computer and they can read everything you do? So when you go into your bank, they can read your password, they can read everything, and just when you get into a session, they take it over. And you're disconnected and they wire transfer out $100,000 or something if you're a corporate account. We've got to contend with this. And so we're graded on how convenient we are, and yet we have to defend and protect all of you and our depositors, shareholders, everybody from this cyber fraud. And this is the big challenge. The risks are huge. Trying to figure out how to walk that line to be the best. And the big banks are pretty good at it. The community banks are trying really fast to catch up the best we can. And that's a direction I think that we're definitely going. Really make it something that is a good experience for the younger generation that just doesn't want to go into a typical office. Although we still will always think it's a personal business, that office will be there for them, that service will be for them, but the delivery channels are going to be different. And so big challenges are with the banks to figure this out. So I look forward to a very interesting future with this, and I look forward to your questions.
Steve, it was hard-earned, but you got my vote.
Thank you. Thank you.
Our next banker is Mike Walker, and Mike's been in the banking business for many years. He's the president of Northern California of U.S. Bank. And as you've sensed, we've kind of got the community bank, the smaller bank, regional, kind of medium-sized bank, and a large bank like Wells Fargo. And it's already turned out that they have different perspectives, and we're going to hear one from Mike, I'm sure. He's a 30-year veteran of the financial services industry with strong background in commercial, corporate, and investment banking, including 23 years with J.P. Morgan Chase and his predecessors. He's a graduate of Georgetown University. His question is, what are banks doing differently following the recent chaos, and what will they have to do differently in the future? He'll then talk about U.S. Bank and bank lending and whatever his script is, I don't know. I didn't know the other two, so I don't expect I know what he's going to say. Let's welcome Mike Walker.
Thank you, Tom, and it's a pleasure to be here this evening with the Commonwealth Club and St. Mary's, and I would echo Steve's comments that it's a real tribute to your organizations that you can fill a room to listen to three bankers on a night where the president's giving a pretty important speech on national television. I've been asked to briefly discuss what banks are doing differently following the recent economic chaos and what they might do differently in the future. I'm going to make a few quick observations and then relate them back to my own institution, which is U.S. Bank. For those of you who may not be familiar with U.S. Bank, we're the fifth largest bank in the country on the basis of total assets. At year-end, our assets were a little over $280 billion, well short of Perry's organization, which is a trillion-dollar organization and a bit larger than Steve's. We also have about 3,000 branches, so we have the fourth-largest branch network in the country, and we're in 24 states with a little over 5,000 ATMs. So we're a big bank, but frankly, we're a pretty easy bank to understand. And, you know, at its core, the way I think about bank lending is it's a pretty simple business. We take in deposits, we lend the money back out, and we return the money to our depositors when they ask for it. That hasn't changed in hundreds of years. But you've got to wrap your head around the fact that a bank can take $1 of deposit and lend it out many times over, provided that we're viewed as a safe place for depositors' money, and that we take appropriate care in terms of making those loans in the first place. So this makes our industry very important to the overall economy, but it also puts us in a position, and Perry referenced this, to help our clients achieve their dreams, and also, if we do our business right and they're successful, we can be a safe place for their money. So we don't take that responsibility lightly. But the current economic environment over the last couple of years, business conditions, and the regulatory environment has forced many banks to realign certain priorities and rethink their approaches in a number of different areas. I'm going to mention a few, but they don't apply to all banks because, as is true in many industries, one size does not fit all. Number one is the rationalization or right-sizing of bank business lines to adjust to the current economic environment. Over the last 2 years, the banking industry is generally downsized. Now, that means many banks are back to focusing on their core business, or they've exited businesses that no longer meet their return criteria or their risk profile. And this is particularly more true for larger banks that have many business lines, or banks that made large acquisitions prior to the downturn, or banks that, generally speaking, are heavily engaged in investment banking or capital markets activities. I would note that the banks on this panel, generally speaking, do not fit that criteria. It's hard to say, though, with any certainty if that trend will continue, because consider this. Earnings estimate for three banks in the 10-bank peer group in which U.S. Bank is generally considered or expected to lose money for all of 2010. That's still pretty staggering when you think about it. And while that may be a small number in the representative universe of banks, it certainly could be indicative of more rationalization to come in the future. I'm fortunate to say that at U.S. Bank, we began the economic downturn with 62 business lines, and today we have 63. So we, in fact, were able to add one along the way. We didn't exit any businesses, and we've been continuing to grow both organically and through acquisitions, such that we've had record revenue the last few quarters. The second issue, and Perry touched on this a little bit, and Steve, this will resonate with you, is the management of capital and liquidity. Before the crisis, dividend increases, share repurchases, and other ways to return capital to shareholders were common themes. It's quite the opposite today. Management of capital and liquidity has become critical to the internal management of banks, and it's also clearly a priority for regulators, rating agencies, bank clients, and other stakeholders. In fact, over the last couple of years, we've had more clients, focus very clearly on how safe their bank is than in any time in my career. And it's pretty simple. In the areas of capital and liquidity, more is better. At U.S. Bank, over the recent past, we've raised common equity, reduced our dividend, and taken a number of actions to ensure that we have solid capital and liquidity positions. We're also have become among the highest rated banks in the country by the major credit rating agencies. So capital and liquidity don't solely determine a bank's safety and soundness, but a bank cannot afford to be short of either, particularly in an environment of uncertain asset values and an economy that's proving very difficult to predict. The third issue is credit costs. Now, prior to the crisis, banks, generally speaking, or more or less would add to their loan loss reserves the amount that they had charged off in that same quarter. This has changed dramatically. Over the last 2 years, institutions need to provide for future loan losses at the expense of current earnings. You know, the numbers total in the billions, tens of billions of dollars. U.S. Bank is no exception. Over the last 3 quarters, however, our provision exceeding our net charge-offs are trending in the right direction. They were 150% 3 quarters ago, 140% this last quarter that we reported ending December, 125%. So the trend is encouraging. But I would tell you that there are many gauges that you can use to determine a bank's future view of the economic conditions in its loan portfolio. So stay tuned to the point where this ratio gets back to zero or close to it. But we are not there yet. Number four, regulatory and legislative oversight. This poses one of the most significant challenges to the industry today, and I would suggest that is a major initiative in banks, small and large. We need to understand, analyze, explain, and in some cases defend all the different bank initiatives that are out there in Washington today, and I will tell you there are quite a few of them. But I'm not going to belabor this point because this could be the entire topic of a discussion this evening. At U.S. Bank, I would tell you we've dedicated more resources than ever to ensure that the appropriate facts are getting out on the table and that our side of the story is being heard. Now, all of these points might seem as if they'd be an impediment to the future of credit and bank lending. Total bank lending measured by the total loans on bank books fell from $7.3 trillion in Q4 of 2008 to $6.7 trillion at the end of 2009. By my math, that's $600 billion. But I would argue quite the opposite and say that the future is very bright for banks that have rationalized their businesses, have strong capital and liquidity, and have a good handle on their loan portfolio. In other words, you can't paint all banks with the same brush. Consider this. Despite the noise in 2009 in the industry and our economy, at U.S. Bank, our loan growth percentage in each quarter in 2009 was as follows. The first quarter ending March 31, our loans grew 19.6%. Second quarter ending June 30, 12.8%. Quarter three ending September 30, 9.3%. In this last quarter in December, we were up 8.2%. Our average loans in 2009 year to year grew by $14.4 billion or just under 10%. I would also add that commitment utilization, which measures an individual or company's ability to draw down on committed credit, fell to an all-time low at year-end of 30%. That gives us empirical data that balance sheets are continuing to deleverage. So many who had the capacity to borrow chose not to and actually paid down their lines. So I would close by saying at U.S. Bank, we're extremely optimistic about the future of bank lending and lending in general. We're an old-fashioned credit underwriter, so not everyone qualifies, particularly with the uncertain economic environment and the challenges that we face. Nonetheless, we're actively looking to grow our lending business. We're open for business with credit-worthy borrowers, and we think, all in all, the future is going to be extremely bright for our bank in particular, and all of the banks for the industry in general. So thank you very much, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you. That's a real upper. Thank you, Mike. We've got some very good questions here, and I'm glad I'm up here, and they're going to take turns answering, or I'll answer, and you can volunteer, or all three of you can speak to it. It seems that banks are still holding vast amounts of foreclosed properties. Is the second shoe going to fall and send us spinning further into recession, or is there another plan for these? Would one of you volunteer for that?
I'll volunteer.
Okay.
You know, I think that's kind of the $64,000 question, so to speak, that we get asked a lot. You know, I get asked a lot about that question, and then also is commercial real estate the next big thing kind of coming on the horizon? And I guess here's my perspective. It's all a question of on the residential side, and again, I'm not a residential expert. I've been a commercial guy my whole career. How quickly jobs come back. And we've already started to see perhaps that we've hit bottom in certain markets that we didn't think we hit bottom in a long time. The Inland Empire in California, for example, which was down 30, 40, 50% in terms of home values, has started to stabilize. We've seen some markets where there's been more than one bid on a home, which is very positive. And I think if those trends continue, then the foreclosure issue isn't going to be quite as dramatic as the numbers show, and we could move out of this. It's not going to be easy, but I don't know that there's another leg down from here relative to that. On the commercial side, I think that relative to other commercial downturns, if you look at the early 90s, if you look at the 80s, I think there is less leverage and there's less issues with those properties than there were back then. I'm not saying we're not going to have problems, but if you look at the quality of the borrowers and you look at the quality of the tenants in some of those properties, you can work out a deal. And so to me, it's not ignoring the issue. It's just that, I've talked to rooms full of investors, believe me, who are angry with me because the banks aren't being hard enough on our borrowers, and they don't get a chance to go buy these buildings at a low enough price. Okay, so these guys are the sharks waiting, and they made a lot of money in the RTC days, and they made a lot of money in the 90s. And I say, guys, don't wait because you might miss it. It might not be as good as it was back then, and there's millions and millions of dollars of capital sitting on the sidelines waiting to, quote, get into the commercial real estate business. And so I think once we get a turn there, or once we get stabilization, this thing could turn very, very quickly. And we could see a market that comes back very, very nicely there. It might not happen in the first quarter, second quarter, and I'm not making a forward-looking statement, nor am I an economist. But there's a lot of money on the sidelines. And so I think that, again, if we get some sort of stabilization from an economic standpoint, we could be through this thing and back to a more normal economic environment in the next few quarters.
I would also add that from a big picture perspective, if I understood the question directly, that being that banks are holding, you know, all these foreclosed assets on their books, and you know what happens when those assets come to either need to be sold in the marketplace or, you know, something else occurs. Keep in mind that as regulated entities, it's in everyone's interest to deal with those assets as expeditiously as possible. And in some, you know, and in some cases, it's not as if a bank or an individual institution, you know, has complete flexibility to determine how long it stays on the balance sheet in some cases. So there's many eyes that, you know, that take a look at you know, at issues such as this, and I think you really need to keep that in mind when you're thinking about the implications from a big picture perspective.
If I could just add a couple of short comments, Tom, on the same subject. I'm not bragging, but frankly, we don't have a single other real estate-owned asset on our books at Mechanics, not one. But we have some real insights of what the big risk is here and understand it very well. And a lot of this will come from something we haven't talked about, which I want to explain to you is the regulatory influence of how this is dealt with. You need to understand this. Okay? I think the good news is we're out of recession now. Bad news is it's going to be a slow, painful recovery, particularly for jobs. And when you have jobs, you have people that can afford homes. When you don't have jobs, it's tough. So there is too much inventory. But we've seen a 40% drop in housing. And at some point, it's very affordable and exciting for people to buy this. And half of the stock market of the United States is sitting in cash outside the stock market waiting for deals. I talk to people all the time putting together $10, $50 million syndicates that want financing to buy all these homes because they know there's a bargain coming, and everyone's waiting for the right time. That's why it probably will be a bounce. Yeah. But on the commercial side, you need to understand that there's a great deal of pressure from the regulators right now. They all want, they've been criticized, you're not tough enough. Congress beats at them, and everyone goes back and they say, you didn't do your job, and they're on top of the banks hard. And so they get appraisals, and they make you mark them down to whatever the appraised value is to have coverage. And this is millions and millions of dollars that they've been hit. You might have a project that's cash flowing and paying every single month and doing just fine. But if you look at the appraised value, which uses a different cap rate, it says it's below margin. Do you write it down or do you not? Barney Frank says you got to give them a little relief. And if it's performing and cash flowing, you don't write it down to the appraised value. If they force us to write them down to appraised value, you're going to see another bloodbath. But if you say, I know in the long run commercial real estate is going to go up in value, and if they're paying and they're current and they're behind it and there's tenants, maybe not full occupancy but reasonable tenants, okay, it's all right right now. What are the regulators going to do? Well, I see a turn right now because now the constituency is going back to Congress and saying, do you know what they're doing to us? And they're going back to say, hey, we meant to be tough, but not quite that tough. And so you see this cycle. I've seen it over and over. You're seeing it again right now. And that's where we are.
Bankers aren't shy, as you can see. I have a number of questions here, so maybe we ought to take turns or something. Thanks. So that was very, very educational for everybody. How do you believe the current financial changes will affect investors and first-time homebuyers? And second, will interest rates rise in 2010? Fourth quarter, I'm going to hang, whoever wants to talk to them, I'm going to hang on your every word for interest rates in the fourth quarter. Does somebody want to respond to that question?
That's you.
I'm not an economist, but I would tell you that interest rates will go up eventually. Maybe not by Q4 of 2010, although one thing that I would encourage everyone, you know, in this room to take a closer look at is what is implied in Fed funds futures, and you know clearly, the general market thinks rates are going to rise at some point, and perhaps as early as this year. Whether you subscribe to that theory or not, I'd say flip a coin. How do you believe the current financial changes will affect investors and first time home buyers? You know, I'm very encouraged about the fact that. First-time home buyers, there are programs out there to get financing. There are, you know, prices are lower and interest rates are lower, as low as they've ever been. I see that it's a great time to buy. The question is, do you have the financial wherewithal to support the purchase? And as we've, you know, talked about in our comments, our business is very much back to back to the way it was in the 70s and 80s. You got to make a down payment. You have to fully document your loan. You have to have a reliable source of income. You've got to be able to service the debt. It's pretty darn simple.
I would agree. Well, I have one for Perry. Would you vote to confirm Ben Bernanke for another term?
Yes.
Yes. That one for Steve. Do you support reinstatement of the Glass-Steagall Act or a similar act? Steve?
Okay. I am really torn on this, and I don't mind telling you I'm very torn on this. I like aspects of the Glass-Steagall Act, and I'm going to explain that what we've done is we've created a supermarket with major institutions of investment banking, insurance, commercial banking, et cetera, et cetera. The cultures are very different, and it's a big challenge to manage this because a commercial bank needs to be very disciplined about its underwriting. It needs to have long-term capital because they're making long-term loans, a certain amount of capital. An investment bank is a deal maker. And these people are paid extremely high for creating opportunities, temporarily financing, and selling the securities. And so they're very driven by short-term incentives, and it's the way you manage an investment bank. And they can have very high leverage because they're not living with a deal for a long time. We're different, okay? And so I think by putting it all together, we've created some frustrations to regulate it because it's hard to know these different cultures and for CEOs to manage all these cultures. And so the reason I'm torn on this, it sounds like I just want to break them up. I really am torn on this because I also know we're in a world-class competitive atmosphere for our institutions in the United States. And if we don't have the strength and stability of FDIC and capital behind some of the other activities that they're competing with world class, then it'll go to the UK or it'll go to Japan or it'll go because they don't have those restrictions. So they're kind of hoping we break them up so they get it all. And so I'm sympathetic that, you know, there is a good argument to keep them together. Frankly, I would like to see them very specialized in their regulation. I don't want to see an investment bank again convert overnight to a Federal Reserve Bank and get bailed out. Rubbish. Let them go. Let them go. But not the commercial banks. Not the foundation of your confidence. That's my view.
I just want to add a quick comment, feeling somewhat compelled of having been in the investment banking industry, to point out that it's very important to distinguish the true risk-taking attributes of the businesses that Glass-Steagall implies, and you know, would tell you that most of the conversation around this topic, or what you read in the papers when it references investment banks, has much more to do with proprietary trading and, you know, and the like, but not necessarily pretty plain vanilla underwriting of corporate debt and equities, et cetera. So you have to really distinguish what are the true attributes of the risk that you want to protect against. And, you know, we'll see where this one goes. But it's, you know, it's
got some major people that are talking about this very thing.
Absolutely.
I have to tell you, my grandfather started a bank the day after Glass-Steagall was signed in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And later on, I found out from my father, he told my father that the reason was that now it'll be hard to lose money in the banking business, but on the other hand, it'll be hard to make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And there's something that rolls through our industry that's like that. I'm going to come back to Mike. Why do banks think a self-employed person borrower is a greater risk than someone employed by a company? Self-employed people can't fire themselves.
Well, I think.
I
think perhaps what we're referring to better frame the issue is just the ability to document and verify income. You know, I wouldn't say that carte blanche, a self-employed person, borrower, is a worse risk than someone employed by a corporation. But I think the issue at the end of the day just boils down to the ability to verify income and document the history of their income and the sources of their income. And, you know, certainly from both in our commercial business, we do business with a lot of self-employed individuals, and they can demonstrate the wherewithal to service the debt that they undertake.
Good, thank you. I've got one for Perry. Please explain the long-term prognosis for credit card interest rates.
Wow.
Here's the question.
Thank you. Well, you know, I mean, this is a very interesting topic. There was some legislation passed, I think most of you in the room know about it, that is going to prohibit banks from doing things relative to credit card rates that had become, I wouldn't say standard practice, but practiced by a lot of folks in the industry. And again, I don't know what everybody does, but I don't think some of the things that were the what I would characterize as abuses were practiced by any of the banks represented here. But be that as it may, I'll talk about it from an industry standpoint. Again, I think it's too early to tell what's going to happen, because what happens is if you put restrictions on financial institutions, let's say we restrict credit card rates to a certain dollar amount or a certain percentage, and we restrict fees and what have you. And I think it sounds good, right? Because we're trying to kind of get a grip on whether something is appropriate or not. I think what tends to happen is over time, you restrict access to credit, and that may be a good outcome. It may not be a good outcome, and I think only time will tell, because financial institutions do a cost-benefit analysis just like any other business, and if it costs them too much to have a certain segment of customer represented in their customer base, they're not going to have that customer base represented, and there's nowhere else for that customer base to go for financing. And then they tend to go to other sources, which are, quite frankly, not as above board as the banks. And so I'm not suggesting that that's the outcome, but I'm suggesting that's a possible outcome of this kind of legislation. So, again, we've had an incredible democratization of credit, and I referred to it in my earlier remarks. I mean, my dog got 3 credit card offers in the past 10 years. So, and I think that's too much. Should only gotten one. He got 3. But again, that's what we're used to as a society. Oh my God, these credit card offers keep coming in. What if they didn't? What if you couldn't get a credit card? Then it's a little different. Then, well, I didn't want that either. I want, so we got to kind of be careful what we're doing here. And I think over time we will see the results of this. Again, it could have possible outcomes. There could be a good outcome, or that risk could show up in a different bucket that we're not thinking about right now.
Thank you. Steve, I have one for you. What do small businesses need to do differently to secure loans in a tight credit market?
I really believe in small and medium business for the future of our economy. They are the ones that are the solution to hiring, solving the employment problem. And they also, I might add, that they are our solution to world-class competitive advantage, because they're entrepreneurial, they're quick on their feet, they adjust very rapidly to the marketplace. It's something really big business is having a harder time to do, as evidenced by the automobile companies and other things. So small business has a big future for us, and we're lucky to have an American market where it's really embraced. There's so many self-employed and small business people. The fact is, I don't believe there truly is a credit crunch on that segment. The real smart ones said, holy cow, this is a horrible 2-year outlook, and they did that 2 years ago, and they contracted, they reduced inventories, they let people go. Can you blame them? They want to get through. They're very fast to react to this, and they are creditworthy. And when they want to come back, we want to be there. We got a lot of them. Very creditworthy. We want to lend to them. They just don't have the confidence yet to come out of this and do their thing. Now, the problem is that any bank analyst will tell you that a brand new business is very, very risky. You want to get the ones that have demonstrated the capacity to lend. And so my answer is, if you're a new business, small business, usually it's not a bank that you want to go to. It's somebody with capital that will back you and has confidence in you and helps you in that first phase. And once you get through that first phase, 4 or 5 years, the banks are dying to lend to you. All they want is a proven track record with some profitability to know that you're going to perform. And so I think we need to rely on our savings and our friends and investors for the early stages, and you need to behave differently to look for getting that way to get started, and then go to the banks. Believe me, we're dying to lend to you. We're anxious.
Good. Thank you. We'll be there. I'm sorry. I'm getting the signal here. We've got one more question, and Mike has been selected as our last question. And this is the question. When do you think construction contractors and real estate investors will believe they can seek traditional bank lending versus hard money loans?
Well, I would tell you that we're lending to construction contractors. We're lending to real estate investors. I think the issue is when somebody says, you know, quote, traditional lending, let's define what traditional lending is. And I think what you've heard this evening is that money and credit is available to creditworthy borrowers. It's not like it was in the period of, you know, the late 90s to 2007 before the downturn. It's a very, quote, traditional market, if you will. You're going to put money down. You're going to have to prove that you have the capacity to pay the money back. It's back to the way it was. And what everybody needs to understand is that worked pretty well for the most part. It really did. You know, we've spent some time this evening talking about the excesses, so to speak, of when things got a little bit out of control and you didn't have to put money down. You didn't have to prove your capacity to pay. You didn't have to verify income, et cetera. But those days are pretty much gone. So I would maintain, as I, you know, said in my comments, and I think is, you know, you've heard from everyone in this panel, banks want to lend. I think there's, you know, there's still plenty of capacity out there. It's just that, you know, borrowers have to prove and perhaps work a little bit harder to demonstrate that, in fact, they're creditworthy.
Well, I have to tell our speakers that we could stay all night because you're so knowledgeable, and thank you so much for coming tonight and speaking with us. Let's give them one last.
You just did a contractor deal.
This is Tom Waller, and on behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California, I certainly want to express deep appreciation for Mike Walker from U.S. Bank, Steve Buster from Mechanics Bank, and Perry Pelos from Wells Fargo, as well as Professor Tom Cleveland from St. Mary's College. This has been a most informative and stimulating, I think, conversation, and it's so true that we could have gone on for quite some time. I just want to also remind everyone that this program has been presented in association with the Graduate Business Alumni Chapter of St. Mary's College of California. And we're just delighted to have done this in partnership between the Commonwealth Club and the Alumni Chapter. So many, many thanks to our speakers. I'm going to ask our audience to please remain in your seats after I gavel the program close, because we have just a short little special thing. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.